Our final speaker for this session and for this year's annual meeting is Sir Ralph Harris, who I think is well known to most of you. Lord Harris taught political science at St. Andrews, which I'm sure all of you know is near Kirkaldy, the birthplace, and I probably mispronounced that too, the birthplace of Adam Smith, which obviously had a profound effect on Lord Harris's thinking. In addition, and it's beyond me why he was insistent that this be a piece of information passed on to you, while still in Scotland, he stood twice for Parliament, which he proudly noted he was almost successful in being elected to. That's usually the sort of thing most of us try and forget, I think. What most of us know him for is his stewardship of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London. He has been general director of the Institute since 1957, and we also know him well as the former secretary and vice president of the Mount Pelerin Society. And if I recall correctly, it was the Mount Pelerin Society's meeting in St. Andrews, commemorating the bicentennial of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, at which Lord Harris relinquished that position. But he served the society for many, many years. It was as a result of his work with the Institute for Economic Affairs that he was made or designated, or however one comes to such a distinction, Lord Harris of Highcross by Queen Elizabeth in 1979 in recognition of that work with the Institute for Economic Affairs. There's an interesting story, I think, which indicates Lord Harris's even-handedness with regard to the topic he's undertaking to address this afternoon, and this has to do with his instruction to hang a picture of Lord Keynes in the boardroom at AEI, at IEA, which purportedly turned up crack the next morning. But the explanation seems to have something to do with the fact that it was hung in the proximity of a picture of Adam Smith, so the damage was attributed to action of an invisible hand. In Keynes's general theory, he suggested digging holes in the ground as a means of soaking up excess labor. Since then, many economists have used up their excess capacity digging holes in which to bury Keynes. If Keynes is still alive, this is a crime of some gravity. If he's dead, then I suppose it's the decent thing to do, although perhaps we've overdone it. Here to perform what may turn out to be an autopsy is Lord Harris of Highcross.
Chairman, I'm a little worried that I may have buried Keynes alive, because certainly burying we are intent upon doing. I have a difficult assignment, and I will do my best to discharge it. After the rough handling of the speakers in the last session, I decided to go straight on to the end of the road and preempt any time for discussion, so that the wedding party can come into a perfectly agreeable setting when we depart. I'm less inhibited than Bill Niskanen may necessarily feel to be, because in the House of Lords I sit on the cross benches, on the independent benches. They are called cross benches for several reasons. One of them, I think, is that you can watch both parties equally and get very cross indeed. But before I come to my formal task, I want to discharge briefly a debt of gratitude to the Philadelphia Society. Aside altogether from the on Heavenly Racket in room 725, which happens to be adjacent to what is laughingly called my bedchamber. I have many reasons to be grateful to the Philadelphia Society. My first visit to Chicago, indeed my first visit to the USA, was for what I think was the first of the national meetings of the association in 1965. I remember very well Don Lipsitt inveigling me over here. In his terms, I was invited to inspect a former colony and see how they were managing without our supervision. And I must say, from a great many friendships that I've formed since those days, one is with dear old Don, and I mustn't say dear old Norma, but with Norma, whom I see less frequently, let me add, because she spends most of her time, as you know, knitting up those Adam Smith ties. In what I assume to have been an unsolicited tribute to the Philadelphia Society, in one of the handouts that we had, Milton Friedman described it as a home or base for the beleaguered minority of intellectuals. Well, I don't know about minority. We seem to be growing a great deal since those early days. And if we are to be beleaguered, I can think of no nicer place than what I, in my own mind, call the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. If I don't seem at home this afternoon, I ask you to forgive me, because I'm not used to addressing large gatherings anymore, but rather small gatherings. I'm not used to addressing young people, indeed mostly elderly, not to say decaying people, most of whom, in a fair invitation, have been asleep. Hence the old quip that about the noble lord who, on these finely upholstered seats, went into a slumber and dreamt he was addressing their lordships, and woke up to find that he was. And another bad habit you get into there is not speaking too loudly. You speak loud enough for the Hansard reporter to pick up your pearls, but not loud enough to disturb the sleepers. Well, now, as an old Cambridge man and a new lord, I'm tempted to come before you not so much to bury Keynes as to praise him. Even without any effort at special pleading, there can't be any doubt that Lord Keynes was a great deal better than most of those who have taken his name in vain to support policies which it is easy to show he would and indeed did repudiate. It wouldn't be difficult to occupy the whole of my allotted time quoting Keynes in most eloquent and explicit defense of the invisible hand, in favor of economic individualism, in praise of capitalism, and in support of that great objective, which I commend to the other side, that economists should aspire to become humble, competent people on a level with dentists. I must admit that Keynes also gave periodic endorsement to such notions as tariff protection, the stagnation thesis, and the need for what he called a somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment, and a variety of other aberrations and delusions. But I always salute Keynes for my favorite passage in the final paragraph of the General Theory, which William Niskanen quoted to you, where he celebrated the gradual encroachment of ideas as the force that ruled the world. It was that hope which in 1957 encouraged the Institute of Economic Affairs to try and turn the tables on the Keynesian consensus that had by then become set in tablets of stone. I might echo Mr. Scannon by saying that in thinking of the power of ideas, I recall the qualification or warning of John Stuart Mill, that ideas, he said, have in general no very rapid or immediate efficacy in human affairs, except when outward circumstances conspire with them. Well, what was the essence of the dominant consensus that came to rule most of the world after 1945? I take it, I hope, that the Philadelphia Society is not today concerned with the small print of the general theory on liquidity preference, the consumption function, the relation of savings and investment ex post or ex ante. I take it we're evaluating his major manifesto for political action. This was characterized by Harry Johnson in the essays in by Milo Keynes, Milo Keynes edited the essays in honor of Keynes. Harry Johnson described the Keynesian propositions as encouraging the following belief, quote, that economic policy can transcend the laws of economics with the aid of sufficient economic cleverness in the sense of being able to satisfy all the demands for security of economic tenure without inflation or balance of payments problems or less obvious sacrifice of efficiency and economic growth. In any discussion of policy prescriptions, I think it's desirable and instructive to distinguish between Keynes and the Keynesians. And on the central issue of the target level of full employment, which I'm mainly concerned with, Keynes consistently displayed a great deal more caution than his more prominent disciples. At the very beginning, chapter 2 of the general theory, he emphasized that what he called full employment would not dispose of either frictional unemployment, which indeed he defined fairly widely to include structural change, nor would it dispose of voluntary unemployment, which he defined in the following, I think, highly significant words. Quote, this is voluntary unemployment. It would be due to the refusal or inability of a unit of labor as a result of legislative or social practices or of combination for collective bargaining or of slow response to change or of mere human obstinacy to accept a reward corresponding to the value of the product attributable to its marginal productivity. The reason that passage is notable is that I believe it would list what Milton Friedman might accept as a fairly good description of the components of what Friedman, in this rather unsatisfactory shorthand, has christened the natural rate of unemployment. The issue between Keynes and those that he contesting amounted to a belief that there was a further category of involuntary unemployment due to a deficiency of total demand, and that justified the government in running a budget deficit. For practical operational purposes, the question appeared to be the minimum level of unemployment above which a Keynesian stimulus would be justified and fruitful in creating sustainable employment. Well, in the 10 years between the publication of the general theory and his death in 1946, when Keynes could still speak for himself, he pitted his influence against the more ambitious exponents of full employment policy. Thus, in 1937, the year after the general theory, when the government, a coalition government, proposed borrowing £80 million for rearmament, equivalent to 1.5% of GNP, Keynes wrote a weighty article in the Times about the danger of inflation. Although unemployment then stood above 1.5 million, or about 12% of the insured population. Even during the euphoria of war, when the unemployment level was below 0.5% of the labor force, Keynes opposed the target of 3% of unemployment that was popularized by Beveridge in a book which my great teacher at Cambridge, Dennis Robertson, always miscalled Free Employment in a Full Society. It was only after Keynes had died that politicians came to regard unemployment of 2%, in Robertson's words, almost as a symptom of the end of the world. To discover whether Keynes would have agreed with the post-war Keynesians, it is not necessary to communicate with the dead. We have first-hand testimony of Hayek documented in a Tiger by the Tail, where he reports their last conversation together a few weeks before Keynes died. Hayek asked Keynes, in the Reform Club apparently, whether Keynes was not getting alarmed about the use some of his disciples were making of his theories. Hayek then recounts his reply, Keynes's reply, was that these theories had been greatly needed in the 1930s, but if they should ever become harmful, I could be assured that he would quickly bring about a change in public opinion. Hayek follows that passage with a telling lament. Quote, what I blame him for is that he called such a tract for the times the general theory, which echoes a point that Bill Liscannon was making. The second testimony for the defense of Keynes is from Colin Clark. In his Hobart paper called Taxmanship, he quotes Keynes in the last year of his life telling Abilene, quote, I am no longer a Keynesian. And my final witness is one you may not always believe, though she is a kind of lady, being the wife of Sir Austin Robinson, who is a kind of economist. In her contribution to the Milo Keynes collection of essays in 1975, Joan Robinson lamented that her friends, quote, had some trouble in getting Maynard to see what the point of his revolution really was. It was Joan Robinson, you may remember, who coined the unladylike phrase of bastard Keynesians. And she coined that for those who dared to remain faithful to the promise of Keynes in his concluding chapter, where he said, I quote from the general theory, filling in the gaps of the classical theory is not to dispose of the Manchester system, but to indicate the nature of the environment which the free play of economic forces requires if it is to realize the full potentialities of production. I would argue that for all Keynes's periodic flirtations with expediencies and compromises and headline-grabbing proposals, it would not be difficult to show that the truly illegitimate offspring, in Lady Robinson's words, the real bastards, are her friends and her who have exploited the great man's name after his death to propagate their increasingly collectivist doctrines. Well, having made an effort to rescue Keynes from the body snatchers at Cambridge, I feel free to assail him for his real crime, which was so powerfully exposed by Buchanan and Wagner. In their remarkable book, Democracy in Deficit, they chose as the subtitle The Political Legacy of Lord Keynes. Thus, Buchanan and Wagner expressed their charge against Keynes as follows. Keynesian economics has turned politicians loose. It has destroyed the effective constraint on politicians' ordinary appetites to spend and spend without the apparent necessity to tax. Keynes's excuse, as revealed in his last talk with Hayek, is that we needn't worry about unbalancing the budget since he would stick around to check any misuse of his theories. That's the man who said that in the long run we're all dead didn't reckon with his own mortality. Buchanan and Wagner attribute Keynes's confidence to intellectual hubris, to what Roy Harrod, in his biography, called the presuppositions of Harvey Road. Harvey Road was where Keynes lived in Cambridge. The presuppositions of Harvey Road that policy would be made by a relatively small group of wise and enlightened people, like Keynes himself, acting, of course, in the public interest and effortlessly triumphant over both political expediency and sexual interests. Well, it didn't take the long run to show that with Keynes had died the last hope of a restraining hand on monetary and fiscal excess. An approximate indication of the influence of Keynesian policy in Britain is provided by the progress of inflation before and after the general theory. In a recent unpublished paper, Professor Ivor Pierce of Southampton University has assembled figures showing that in the almost seven centuries since the year 1300, for which we have statistics, the general price level of comparable goods has risen about 300-fold. Of that inflation over seven centuries, 96% has taken place since the year 1936. The evil potentialities of the Keynesian consensus for British inflation was obscured so long as the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates worked to impose some check on the relative depreciation of the pound. A decisive milestone in our dissent was the Radcliffe Report of 1959, which downgraded monetary policy in favour of the nebulous concept of liquidity. Two prominent Cambridge Keynesians gave evidence. The first, Lord Kahn, urged that in the absence of a wages policy, it would be, quote, economically expedient to abandon any idea of the stability of the price level. Not to be outdone, Lord Caldor offered similar advice under the mischievous title, I quote, The Danger of a Regime of Stable Prices. The history of the next two decades could be briefly outlined. The Labour government that came into power in 1964 under Wilson promptly appointed Caldor and Balog as economic advisers, devalued the pound in 1967, and in defiance of its pledge to the unions, installed a full-scale incomes policy which prepared the way for its defeat in 1970. Ted Heath took over and within a year floated the pound as a prelude to sowing the biggest inflation in British history, which was obligingly harvested by Labour after winning the 1974 election. Over this period, inflation, which had crept at 2 or 3% in the 1950s, speeded up to 5 to 8% in the 1960s and started galloping at 10 to 25% in the 1970s. Unemployment, which had been fine-tuned at 300,000 or 400,000 after 1945, never fell below 500,000 after 1967, rose to 1.5 million under Labour in the mid-1970s and has doubled to 3 million by 1982. In bold summary, the story up to 1979 was that ever larger monetary injections registered a diminishing effect on employment and an increasing impact on the price level. The intended stimulant of monetary expansion acted rather as a sedative that sapped the will to tackle the root causes of the British disease. And even worse, the monetary drug became addictive. The rate's progress is brought home by comparing two four-year periods. Thus, over the four halcyon Macmillan conservative years of 1958 to 1962, over that period, an increase in nominal national income, if you like total spending, of 25% over 4 years, reflected a 12.5% increase in real output and a roughly equal rise in the price level. Over the last four Wilson-Carrigan years, 1974 to 78, an increase in total spending of almost 100% brought about a rise in output of 8% and an increase in prices of more than 90%. It was about this time that I wrote my favorite article under the title, Cheer Up, Things Are Getting Worse. The explanation for this worsening performance was the fading of the money illusion. Politicians never ceased throughout this period to pay lip service to moderating wage costs in order to keep down inflation. But as Frank Pish of the LSE used to say, in watching politicians, as with conjurers, you should keep your eyes on their hands, not on their mouths. So long as politicians, in pursuit of the will-of-the-wisp of full employment, adopted a permissive monetary and fiscal policy, trade unions could extract unearned wage increases from managements who knew they could safely pass on higher costs by raising prices. Thus did the expectation of inflation become a self-fulfilling prophecy. As people came to anticipate inflation, Keynesian monetary expansion had less and less effect on real magnitudes like output or employment and more effect on nominal terms of wages and prices. Well, by 1979, my case is that the Keynesian full employment machine had been tested to destruction. Here was Mill's favorable outward circumstances for change that now conspired with Milton Friedman's reformulation of the quantity theory idea to transform opinion and bring the prospect of a sharp redirection of economic policy. Alas, in addition to inflation rising from 10 towards 15%, the grim inheritance of the Conservative government in 1979 included other deep-seated ailments linked to the collapsing Keynesian collectivist consensus. Thus, public spending was also on an upward course, with mounting deficits of nationalized industries adding to the bowling requirement. At the same time, in a vain effort to win cooperation from the trade union leaders, Labour had increased the power of unions to obstruct efficient production, to maintain overmanning, and so to depress the real return on capital, which had fallen from above 10% in the 60s to below 5% in 1979. Again, to buy union favour, Labour had also introduced employment protection, boosted social benefits, raised payroll taxes, and in other ways simultaneously reduced both the demand for labour and the supply of labour. Falsified by a collapse of its incomes policy, which has always acted like a time bomb and brought a delayed explosion of wages by 20% to 30% in a single year after the 1979 election. But from the day of her victory, Mrs. Thatcher never wavered in showing by both mouth and hands that the defeat of inflation by squeezing monetary demand took precedence, not only over maintaining jobs, but also over a rather central objective of liberating the economy by reducing taxes to stimulate more efficient output. Supply-siders, I fear, would find little to cheer in her record so far. It's true that her faithful Chancellor of the Exchequer in his first budget made large cuts in direct taxes, in income tax, especially at the top rates. But they were paid for by doubling VAT, which promptly added almost 4% to an inflation rate already rising towards 15%, thereby providing at least a plausible pretext for higher wage claims. There has been a certain amount of mostly marginal liberalisation of economic markets, but the chief strain of the fight against inflation has fallen upon monetary policy, operating most severely in the private sector. The centrepiece was the medium-term financial strategy launched in 1980, which specified up to 1984 declining annual targets for both the public sector borrowing requirement and the rate of increase in the money supply. Well, although the chosen measure of M3 has been seen to have overshot, there are, I think, convincing grounds for saying that the figures are distorted. Certainly, such monetary experts as Alan Waters and Gordon Pepper point to the consistent behaviour of the narrower measures of money, both M1 and the monetary base, to argue that the government, whether by luck or judgment, have exerted about the right degree of pressure on the economy. From a record level of 22%, inflation has fallen to 11% in just over 2 years. If the nationalized industries had responded as well as the private sector, average prices would have risen by no more than around 5% per year. Here we see the contrast between what I have now come to call the economic law of gravity, governed by the profit and loss motive which keeps costs down, and the political law of levity, driven by the vote motive which keeps costs up. The government's determination to keep a tight hold of the money supply, despite deep recession, has undoubtedly influenced both expectations and behaviour. In the effort to avoid joining the swelling ranks of the unemployed and the bankrupt, workers and management have not only settled wage claims well below the inflation rate, they have also shed decades of industrial bad habits by tackling overmanning, demarcation, and other slack working arrangements. One of the most dramatic statistics in this period is that manufacturing output per man rose by 10% over the last year. The short-run effect is seen in record unemployment, but it is not only ministers who have begun to discern a new foundation for economic rebirth. Evidence of the Keynesian retreat is glimpsed even among the warring opponents of Mrs. Thatcher, who are still haunted by the ghost of Keynes. Of course, they still talk about reflation. But apart from Lord Caldor, who goes on raving in the Times about a shortfall of £40 billion, The majority of Labour and Social Democrat spokesmen mostly talk of a much more modest boost, and they are careful to emphasise that it would be financed by borrowing from private savers so as to minimise the impact on inflation. Mr. Chairman, champions of the free society always knew that monetarism is not enough. Perhaps the most stubborn survival from the vanishing age of Keynes is the mental habit of discussing policy in macro terms of total spending, output, investment, even the money supply, to the neglect of such micro market realities as individual incentives. Well, we are now winning the argument that in the absence of monetary accommodation, excessive wages price people out of jobs, just as excessive taxes price people into the underground economy. But it must be admitted that many of Mrs. Thatcher's more conservative colleagues, not conservative in your sense, but conservative in the party political Tory sense in England, many of her more Tory colleagues are still unwilling to scale the barriers to mobility and market flexibility by tackling social benefits, rent control, and above all, government spending, which holds the key to reducing taxes on effort, thrift, and high enterprise. This is surely the only non-Keynesian road to the maximum level of sustainable employment. Of course, we should not underrate the power of obstruction by unions, bureaucrats, pressure groups, and all kinds of vested interests, which have been entrenched by the often well-intended social policies. But I draw encouragement from the timeless wisdom of David Hume. Quote, though man be much governed by interests, yet even interest itself and all human affairs are entirely governed by opinion. So I come to my final thought. I dare say even in this kind of gathering, there will be much to argue about and against in George Gilder's Wealth and Poverty. I want to conclude with a thought that it is a tract for the next phase in our battle of ideas. It may be that I'm too impressed in the House of Lords by the occupants of the bench of bishops, who, according to my friend Lord Beloff, would have some difficulty in distinguishing Leon Trotsky from St. Francis of Assisi. But since the IEA started in 1957, I have increasingly come to believe that the economic case for free markets needs to be reinforced by a surer grasp and advocacy of its moral superiority over politicized markets. It's on this vital front, I think, that George Gilder provides such powerful, long-range and high-level artillery support. We have to show that the sin of the compassion lobby and the interest mongers is not simply that of promising to do good with other people's money. Its more general tendency is to do evil at the cost of the supposed beneficiaries. In the words of Robert Woodson, whom some of you may remember at an earlier meeting on Thursday, I think it was, he said, from wide experience among the poor and the blacks in American ghettos, the poor, he said, need to be saved from their champions. I think we can draw encouragement that the Keynesians were laid low, if they have not finally been laid to rest, by the conjuncture of bad experience and better ideas. We must now redouble our economic, political, and I would say moral critique of governmental welfare and labour market policies. Cheer up. These manifestations of collectivism are failing nicely and should become daily more vulnerable to our concerted intellectual attack.
Before your onrush of questions, there's a special presentation of a Stephen Decatur shirt in the event that Lord Harris should be called to service in the Falkland Islands. This award was made possible by the Stephen Decatur shop, where similar t-shirts can be obtained in North Adams, Michigan.
I don't know whether this makes me professional, but I think I'm just giving a plug for this shirt.